Hi, this is Michael Dell. You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast.
Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're going to learn today.
Innovate like a startup. Deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's going to be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 53. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Aero, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, my friend, welcome back.
Yeah, I was trying to think of something.
Yes, go ahead.
I was trying to think of something clever to say, but I'm so out of practice on this. It's been over a month, I think, since we've done this.
Oh, yeah. Well, John, we've missed you very much. You know, we've had some good episodes without you. We've had some good co-host helping. Hopefully you heard the episodes, but it's good to have you back, my friend.
It is good to be back.
All right, and crashing cheesy music. Welcome back, Mr. John. So, John, I'm so glad you're back for this one. This is a conversation we had a few weeks back before you went on vacation and all that. We were talking to some of our coworkers about having some sort of IT influence within your company. And a couple of great ideas came out of that, and certainly some cool experiences from some of our peers. And I thought, what a great idea to bring them on, share some of these stories, and get their opinions on how to be more effective when it comes to IT influence. What do you think about that?
It sounds like an awesome idea.
For sure, for sure. All right, so let's bring them on. Let's not waste any time. Joining us are two coworkers on the vSAN team, first of which is Mr. Jeff Hunter. Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Pete. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is your second or third time coming on. So, yeah, welcome back.
Yeah, I typically listen, right? So it's been a while since I've been on, but you've got a pretty interesting topic going here, and I thought I could chime in a little bit from some previous experience. So thanks for having me.
And also joining us is another veteran of the podcast, Mr. Pete Keeler. Pete, I think this is like your third time now, right?
This is number three for me, yes.
Nice. So, John, do me a favor. Why don't you set this up for us? We want to talk about IT influence. And what do you think are some of the more important factors to consider when trying to be more influential within your company?
So, I mean, part of my thoughts on this go back to spending 5 years consulting. And I saw people who were brilliant, and I saw people, you know, who were, they were good. They were good. But was often interesting was technical skill did not always correlate to influence or ability to get things done. I watched people who had great ideas to improve their business or deploy new IT systems or get adoption.
Yeah.
I saw there were almost a unrelated correlation with success in that regard. And there's, you know, people talk about soft skills or things like that, but I thought it was worth drilling into how do you show influence in your organization? How do you get projects accomplished? How do you get projects adopted? How do you get budget for things? This is something that it's kind of a mysterious zone for a lot of people. I thought it'd be a good topic.
Absolutely. And so, Pete, one of the things we wanted to talk to you about was a blog you posted a while back before you even started at VMware. And the blog was titled Getting the Big IT Purchase Approved. Now, we all know that's not an easy task to accomplish, especially on the smaller companies. But I'm curious what your input is. Why don't you give us a little background on the motivation behind this blog post, and then we can dive into some of the tips that you learned.
Yeah, most certainly, Pete. So one of the things that I wanted to do with that blog post is simply to share some of my experiences that I learned firsthand in what was successful and what was not successful in getting some of these IT purchases approved. So everything that I really listed there as far as tips and tricks and things that worked for me, I felt that those could be helpful to other people in other organizations, whether it's a large organization or a small organization. Each have very unique challenges, but yet some of these same strategies can be applied in order to help people better understand some of the challenges that exist and what some of the options are in order to help fix those problems or provide a better solution.
I would say, and feel free to add to this, John or Jeff, sometimes making some influence internally can be harder than sometimes externally. I've been a consultant. When you go to a consultant and you're the authority and you go to a place and say, hey, this is what you should do. And people usually will open up their checkbooks and say, okay, we trust the consultant. Let's do this. You know, once you've got
magic consultant field.
Yes.
Magic consulting force field.
Right.
Like, Yeah, like you ask the system and like, hey, you got a proposal to replace Exchange Server? He's like, yeah, here's mine for the past 5 years. I'm like, hold on, let me put my logo on this. Yeah.
But internally, not so easy, right?
No. It's a different, you're one of 1,000 internal voices, you know, all asking for money and budget. So
Pete, you being the internal influencer, you clearly have had some fails and some wins on that. Why don't you share what you learned with that?
Yeah. So I think one of the assumptions that many people in IT make about some of the challenges that they have is that these common problems inside of IT are well understood by the rest of the staff that they're providing the services to. One example was the case where in the environment that I was managing, some of the backup solutions that we had were not really sufficient based off of the amount of data that we were trying to protect and the frequency and so forth. But very few people understood what those problems were and why when it came to being able to restore that data. So from there, I really started a monthly series in which it was essentially a lunch and learn in which anybody was invited. And I would cover what was going on in IT over the, you know, the past 30 days or so.
Yeah.
And that was my opportunity to sort of slip in these thoughts and these impressions about what some of the challenges are, so that then when there was something, you know, a little bit more prescriptive with regards to a specific solution that I was hoping to get fully purchased, that I would have a better understanding from the key stakeholders.
And I like how you're proactively bringing that up, because I've seen many cases where people were unsuccessful in getting budget for necessary things on availability or data integrity for backups and things, where I think the IT, it was purposeful, as bad as it sounds, and sometimes it wasn't, but they would kind of hide the deficiencies of the infrastructure, and you'd have, you know, tapes that were outdated and had been cleaned and half the jobs were failing and they're horribly out of compliance, but no one in compliance or no one at the executive knows that, you know, there's a 50-50 shot of us recovering data. And you don't necessarily want to come off as alarmist. I think some people, they don't want to show some of the deficiencies of the infrastructure. They feel that somehow correlates to them. And that's kind of a weird thing to proactively talk about for a lot of people.
Yeah. And I would add also to that, I think one of the things that I learned through that process is that, you know, for many in IT, we're all very passionate about what we think the right thing to do is with regards to, you know, a solution that should be purchased or some new strategy that should be employed within an organization. But you do have to take a step back and say, you know, what's really in the best interest of the organization? And so a lot of times, you know, whether you're able to get something approved or maybe it falls short, the ultimate goal is really for the betterment of the organization. And so I learned through that process how to disconnect myself, you know, a little more emotionally from the ultimate choice that was made for that organization, whether they were going to move forward with the purchase right now, not move forward at all, or maybe hold off for another year.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. You also talked about priming the pump. And so what does that mean?
Yeah, so that was really with regards to several ways that I would try to help others understand what the challenges were within IT. I recall in one case, we had several challenges within the software development group in which they needed to have systems that were faster so that they could provide these services and compile their code all that much faster. But yet I was constrained based off of the actual amount of hardware that we had in order to move forward with some of their objectives. So that's where, for them specifically, I would go in to the software development team and focus the conversation around what was being performed within IT to help them. Because oftentimes, and I think this can happen from an IT organization to many of its customers internally, is that there can become sort of this adversarial sort of relationship. And that was sort of to help bridge the gap in helping them understand that ultimately I was there to help them. And that's something that further on, when it came to looking for budget approval on a number of different matters, then I had the support from that department in order to make sure that those purchases were approved later on in the year.
I like it. So providing some sort of internal influence, you know, before you actually present your presentation, getting other people on board saying, hey, that would be a good idea. Hey, I do have that need. I like it. A Game of Thrones reference here, but that's kind of like, what's that guy's name that's always with all of the kings and queens providing guidance and counsel?
Littlefinger.
Littlefinger, exactly. Yeah. You're the Littlefinger, well, Pete.
You know.
All right, Pete, so you've done your homework. You know exactly what the company needs. You've primed the pump a little bit. You've got some people on board. You know exactly what you want to present to them. Is there any consideration around the actual presentation to leadership?
Yes. I think one of the lessons that I learned through that process was that you really have to adjust the messaging in order to speak specifically to the sensibilities of, let's say, your management team. So that is not the time for you to use all of the technical terms that they may or may not be familiar with.
Yeah.
Frankly, at that point, they don't care. What they really care about are some of the challenges of the business. And that's such a tremendous opportunity for you to be able to become that a trusted advisor for them. And that's it's really an interesting sort of way to be able to present it, is that ultimately, and most of the time, it's a very non-technical matter. It's very business oriented. So that was something that I noticed after the fact that I would recommend really to anyone is to change or adjust the messaging to be reflective of your audience.
Know your audience. That's always good information.
Yeah, Pete, I would agree with that. There was one point when I was working for a bank here in Columbus, Ohio, where we had to sell the idea of utility computing. So as opposed to going down the path of talking about technical terms and so forth, what we did there is we actually compared it to utilities. So we talked about things such as electric, natural gas, water. Utilities can be requested and turned off as needed. You only pay for the amount that you use. Terms like that, they started understanding what we were going for at that point. So in many cases, it makes sense to use analogies to help get your point across. And I found that that's a pretty effective way to do that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Know your audience and speak in terms that make sense to them. I think that's pretty good.
So I think that's also a good opportunity for you to showcase the fact that you have really prepared well for understanding what the challenges of the business are. I think knowing the counterpoints, knowing the potential responses that you might receive from making these proposals is really important, because you can demonstrate that you've done your due diligence through this process and that you're focused on achieving the objectives, not just buying something new and shiny.
I mean, there's a lot of ways to amass those counterpoints, and some of that's kind of starting small, so to speak, you know, meeting with one person for lunch who you think might be opposed to the idea and going ahead and talking to them. That way you can kind of prepare to know what the typical concern points would be. And you can talk through in a one-on-one. When you're in a 1-on-8 or 1-on-12 meeting and you're presenting an idea and someone brings up a counterpoint, it's a lot hard to, you know, on the spot talk through that while there's 8 other people who don't either don't care or, you know, it's just a much more difficult area. So that's having those counterpoints is a great thing to have ready, but kind of having that process of vetting with 1 or 2 small one-on-one meetings beforehand, that can help a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes even if someone spreads a counterpoint or even a sprinkle of doubt when there are more people around, even though you can answer it appropriately, sometimes just that question will start to put doubt in someone's mind. Whereas you speak to them in advance, you give them all the technical information that they need. So when you do come to the table with the decision makers, that has already been hashed out for the most part. I think that's probably a good idea. All right, so we've done our preparation. We've primed the pump. We've got the key stakeholders involved. We had conversations, explained all the technical information, if possible, before the decision makers are in the room. We have a productive meeting and we get it approved. I think that's half the battle. Jeff, I want to talk a little bit with you more specifically about the next phase, the adoption phase. You've got approval, your solution is now in place, but now your organization needs to start using said technology, which to me is a whole nother hurdle. Do you have any insight on that, Jeff?
Yeah, certainly. I think part of that too is you're getting buy-in with, you know, the folks, the stakeholders, the budget approvers and so forth. Is also make sure that you include in the conversation a roadmap. Okay, so once we buy this, what are we going to do with it? So make sure you outline that for those folks too. That also serves another purpose. It gives you a roadmap to actually follow as you start to roll this out. That way there's a plan there. So you demonstrate competency in developing that plan. And now you have a plan in front of you where you can move forward and actually implement that in a timely manner to get the return on investment. Because that's what the stakeholders are going to be looking for. They're going to be looking for that return on investment, before they're willing to invest additional funds to expand, you know, an environment or an infrastructure or whatever the case might be. So I think that's a key piece too, is to have that roadmap up front, present it, make sure everybody understands it, and then follow that roadmap. So that way you get adoption in a timely manner. Now, once you have it in place, another challenge is, you know, I guess getting people to adopt the technology. You know, Pete Keeler talked about in his blog article that oftentimes the most competitive piece is business as usual. And I'll tie this back to my experience when virtualization was first becoming hot. You know, I've worked at VMware for about 10 years, so that gives you a timing idea of how far back I'm going here. But again, at a large organization, an insurance company, we had a hard time convincing business units that, hey, virtual machines are the way to go forward here. No longer are physical machines required for everything, but of course, everybody, they were server huggers. They wanted to hang on to their physical boxes. They were afraid of VMs. They were scary things. So we had to figure out creative ways to get them, number one, to buy into it, and number two, actually move forward with it in production. So some of the things we would do there is, of course, chat one-on-one, you know, regular project meetings and so forth. But we found that adoption was still a little bit stifled in that case. We needed to grow this even further because it made sense for a number of reasons to do this. Financial, ease, implementation speed, all of those benefits that we talk about when it comes to virtualization, all applied back in those days just the same. So what we would do is we would actually have certain cases where we would showcase IT offerings, if you will. And we actually set up a table. So it was like almost like a fair, an IT fair, if you will. We had multiple tables set up, and each of the folks were kind of like vendors at a trade show. They were peddling their service offerings to the rest of the business units. Again, this insurance company was large. We had a central IT group. So in often cases, we were coming up with new products and we were saying, hey, we've got this new thing for you to do. Why don't you give it a try, Mr. or Miss Business Unit? And as part of that, we would set these fairs up and those folks would literally come around and they would just ask questions. So I've heard about this virtual machine thing. Can you tell me more about it? And that's where it would give us an opportunity to spend 60 seconds or 90 seconds with that person and talk about the benefits of using virtual machines versus physical boxes, such as faster provisioning, less expensive, all the usual suspects there.
Yep, yep.
So we found that was pretty effective. Another method that we used was a newsletter. So this was something that the IT department had started, I don't know, maybe a few months before we got the virtualization stuff approved and in the production environment and so forth. So we decided to write an entire Tech Times article or newsletter, if you will, dedicated just to virtualization. But rather than it being just a dry product sheet, like here, these are VMs, here's what they do, here's how you can get them, we spun it in the form of a newspaper, and we got a lot more reaction out of that simply because of the uniqueness of the communication there. So it looked just like a newspaper. It even had ads in it. For example, you could see a classified ad that says, "Great location, virtual machine server located in the upscale North data center area, numerous amenities, fast CPU, 1 gigabyte of memory, and 20 gigabytes of customer usable disk space, short-term lease options available.
Nice.
Lease one for a month or several. No amortization. Call today for your virtual tour." So we had a great time with that, and that really boosted awareness, and eventually those first 50 VMs grew to the first 500 VMs and beyond. So great success story there from an internal marketing perspective.
Now, did you sell cars at some point just with that language there? I mean,
oh, heck yeah, I did. Every person should sell used cars at some point. That is the most educational job you could possibly have. It teaches you a lot about people. It teaches you a lot about sales. And it teaches you about credit ratings, too, which is always a good thing. But if you can sell used cars, you can sell just about anything. So I think that's a great job to have. And I am super glad that I had that when I was taking college classes. So, yeah, good guess there, John.
Jeff's got one of those voices where I don't care what you're selling, I'm buying it.
Pete, I've got some oceanfront property in Kansas for sale, by the way.
Exactly.
What a great example, though, that is, in that, you know, you're using various forms of communication in order to provide much better visibility to what's going on inside of IT. And I think that's one of the things that happens so often within these various organizations, is that IT is perceived as this hole in which money is streams into, and they don't really understand what is going on, what is being received from there, and what are some of the challenges. And these are just all different ways that really go a long way in being able to provide that better visibility.
Absolutely.
So as in any sales process, you tend to focus on the bells and whistles, right? That's what us technology folks do. We talk about, oh, look at this cool feature. Look how it works. And oftentimes we forget to tout the benefits of that. And that was also another key piece that we made sure was the centerpiece or the highlight of that newsletter and any data sheets or anything like that that we produced for internal marketing purposes to help folks adopt virtual machines is we made sure we talked about the benefits. So whether you're pitching the idea for the first time, or you're trying to get adoption for it or additional funding, a key thing there is to make sure that everybody in the audience knows very clearly what the benefits of doing this are. Maybe it's a return on investment. If you're able to measure that, if you're able to do a rearview mirror type of look at what has already happened and say, look, we saved $3.6 million over the past 5 years doing this, naturally, that's going to speak very highly of the solution that you proposed. And it's going to grease the skids to make it a lot easier to get additional funding to grow that that solution offering or whatever the case might be.
One of the things that I've also noticed and what I found is as being really effective in this process is to do a bit of a retrospective on how you approached trying to get something approved. I had a case in which we were looking through or we were looking for a DR solutions for the organization that I was with. And I made a formal presentation to the key stakeholders. And after the process, and you know, of course, after it was approved, I was sort of reevaluating what went well and what didn't go well. And one of the people in the management team had shared with me that one particular slide that I showed of a building burning down was highly effective, in particular because it was the picture of the building of one of the competing companies.
Oh no!
For the company that I was working for.
Oh. So,
and it was right down the street. So
you didn't turn to the audience and wink knowingly as you put the slide up, did you? Like,
so here I don't know how many slides I had in that presentation, but what I realized after the fact and what they had shared with me was that all I really needed was that one image.
Fire, flood, and blood, the things that not everyone plans for in data center resiliency.
Yeah, exactly. So Jeff or Pete or even John, for that matter, any bad memories of ideas that possibly failed in this process?
I mean, the stack of I told you so and, it, you know, before, you know, something awful happens. It's just not something a part of memory lane I really want to go down. One of my biggest regrets in my career was the one time in all my consulting where I pretty much got thrown out of a consulting engagement and told I was an alarmist. And I mean, it ended up with someone going to jail for 10 years who I warned about and a data loss and destroyed storage arrays and all kinds of crazy stuff. But at the same time, I still kick myself for not being better in my rhetoric and being better in my arguments to make that clear. It's something where you, even if they don't listen, you've got to make sure that you're continuously improving those arguments to make sure it gets across of why you should do something.
I would say another thing to be cautious of is actually overselling an idea. Make sure that you're transparent with your audience, with the stakeholders, with the folks that are providing funding. Make sure they understand the limitations of whatever you're proposing too, because nothing worse than, you know, getting approval for something, spending all of that money, promising the world, but only be able to deliver part of that, right? And then, you know, what's going to happen there is your odds of getting additional funding in the future for that type of project or any other project for that matter are going to be greatly reduced. So again, transparency is key. Make sure everybody understands what can and can't be accomplished as part of the proposal. And, you know, that's going to improve your odds too if expectations are set properly.
Yeah, I did see quite a few cases, Jeff, like what you're describing there, where people would overpromise, say, oh, this is going to be 100% available, and then ignore the fact that it's all in one building and doesn't have a generator. Or overpromise, you know, get partway through. I've seen cases where there was an 8-year-old storage array that was dying. This new array will last us 3 years. They didn't calculate the RAID properly. And there was the smell of shame and disappointment when they could only move 80% of the data off. So double checking and making sure and working with your vendors and your contracts to make sure that stuff is sized. And don't ever promise 100% availability or uptime or performance.
Yeah, because you'll always be remembered as the guy who overpromised. And that's a hard thing to shake. So steer clear of overpromising.
I would also say that when you think about timelines, too, one of my favorite rules of thumb double a timeline. So, hey, it's going to take us 3 weeks to get this done. Tell the stakeholders 5 or 6 weeks, because chances are things aren't going to go smoothly. You're going to need that additional time. I would rather set an expectation up front and then pleasantly surprise someone versus set a more aggressive expectation just because that's what they want to hear, but then turn around and miss that deadline. So again, it's always a good idea to sandbag just a little bit. But at the same time, if you make a habit of that and people consistently see you beating your deadline by, let's say, 50%, then that becomes an expectation. So that's a tricky line to walk there, but always put a little bit of buffer in your project timeline. Any good project manager is going to tell you that.
Yeah. And I think too, with regards to a lot of these various projects or implementations of new technology, oftentimes IT organizations will treat that in sort of a waterfall mentality. So they won't reveal anything until it's fully implemented. And then they say, okay, now let's go use it. And I don't think that that's a very effective strategy for buy-in during the implementation process. Look for opportunities in which you can roll things out, you know, in a phased approach or even a pilot approach. Now, sometimes there are challenges with that with respect to, you know, things become so rapidly adopted that, you know, you may fall a little bit behind with regards to some of your other obligations. But it's a good opportunity for you to sort of prepare and showcase what is being done and how this project, whatever it might be, is actually moving forward.
So one persuasive thing I've heard is get to know your accountants and finance, you know, learn what it is they're looking for in terms of how you spend the money. It can almost be as much as how much that money is. I'm curious if you guys have seen anything in that regard, and this is probably something we may need to go into further detail later on.
You mean like CapEx versus OpEx, understanding what kind of money you're spending within your company?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's that, you know, it's a lot of it's been made about, you know, cloud solutions being this magical thing for, instead of it being a big lump sum, it's, you know, pay go model. Although we're starting to see some cases of, you know, pay as you go coming to, you know, leases or traditional infrastructure. So was that something you saw a lot of wrestling back and forth of? Do we spend it all up front, or do we pay as we go on kind of a monthly or lease model?
Yeah, John, in my experience, most cases, the accounting folks at the few organizations that I worked at, they preferred the OpEx expenditures. They didn't want to spend the CapEx up front. If there was a way to charge this against OpEx, and every organization is different, but if there was a way to charge it against OpEx, that's what they preferred in most cases. You know, another thing to be aware of, too, is from an accounting perspective, is how do they charge back? Because one of the problems we had, you know, we talk about cloud computing and that pay-as-you-go type of model, the challenge we had with implementing it had nothing to do with the technology, but rather the way budget funds were allocated. There was no easy way at that point in time for the accounting department to charge back to a specific business unit or for one BU to charge back to another one. So it made it very difficult to charge for an individual virtual machine, let's say, or for X amount of weeks versus over the course of 2 or 3 years. So it does make a lot of sense to talk with the accounting folks, understand those dynamics, at least at a high level, and get some guidance from them too as to how the solution can be implemented. Because, you know, like I said a moment ago, your main challenge may have nothing to do with the technology. As a matter of fact, I find that to be the case more often than not.
Yeah, I would echo those very same thoughts there, Jeff. I had the good fortune of sitting right next to our finance department and had several opportunities to, you know, ask them about some of the things and learn from them in a way that I could maybe use some of that information for some of my presentations and how I pitched something. And oftentimes what I learned, especially in that particular environment, was that we were a software development company. And so some things were tax exempt and some things were not. And I had to look at how I could frame these purchases in ways that would be advantageous for our company to be able to make those purchases in the most financially lucrative way.
It's surprising, too, how much power an accounting controller has within an organization. I learned that pretty quick, too. There's often times where management might say, "Nah, we don't like this idea. I don't think that's the right way to go." But then the controller steps in and says, "You know what? This is very beneficial from an accounting perspective. So I think we need to explore this further." And in some cases, a project will get derailed by management in IT, for example, only to be put back on track because of accounting reasons or the CFO saying, "Yeah, we're doing this. We're looking at this. Let's keep moving forward."
I like it. In essence, you truly have to be a car salesman. I mean, you have to sell the car itself for the benefits of the car, but then you also have to find the proper financing for your customer.
Jeff, this sounds like we're the guys like, we're not buying the car. And you're like, wait a minute. The wife's the one who controls the checkbook. Like, I'm talking to her instead. So. Yeah.
I can get you a lease at 0% financing.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. As a matter of fact, we just bought a new Honda. And guess who picked out the majority of the features for that particular ride? It wasn't me.
Happy wife, happy life, Jeff.
That is the truth.
All right, gentlemen, I think this is a pretty good conversation around being more influential within your IT organization. I think we could probably peel off several of these topics, like the CapEx versus OpEx, for example, and spend another half an hour discussing some of the considerations. But I think this will do for this episode. Gentlemen, I know you're all going to be at VMworld, mostly delivering awesome sessions for partners and customers around vSAN. So instead of spieling out all the sessions, I will lead all of the vSAN sessions that you will be doing on the show notes of this podcast. And we will see you at VMworld. Thank you so much for coming. John, before we let them go, any last thoughts?
My last thought is I like this series. I think we got a lot of different angles to explore. And, you know, it's fun to talk about the tech, but if you can't purchase it and you can't deploy it,
yeah,
you know, kind of boring.
I agree. All right. Well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. Subscribe to us on SoundCloud or iTunes by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. Next week, we're going to be talking some vSAN stretch cluster with Jace McCarty. And so until then, bye for now. Welcome back, John.
It's going to be home. It's going to be home. I was afraid my dog wasn't going to recognize me.
There's no place like home.
You know, there is a place like home, but I will say, Bali was pretty fun, as was Thailand and Cambodia and everywhere else, you know?
I am profoundly dumbfounded.
Me too, John.
Oh, God.
Enough of this jibber jabber.